Well, welcome to the Global War on Terror. Are we fighting the right war? Nearly 7 years ago, George W. Bush said, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." This panel will explore what is now called the Global War on Terror, and the approach the U.S. and its allies are taking to address it. Today, these approaches are dominated by military acts of disruption that are tactically offensive but strategically defensive, to steal a phrase from David Kilcullen, an advisor to General Petraeus. Is this approach in itself sufficient to win the war on terror, or do we also have to address the root causes of terrorism against the United States, which is dominated by Islamic extremists? To address the second issue, which has been discussed extensively this week at Aspen, there are many questions about what this war is about. Is it, as Bernard Lewis suggests, a clash of civilizations? That is, the continuation or culmination of the Christian-Muslim conflicts that started with the rise of Islam in the 7th century? Or is it an internal struggle in Islam, such as the one Christianity experienced in the Reformation, that has embroiled the West? Is it a direct response to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and a desire for a seat at the global table for Muslim nations, constituting 900 million people? Is it a war of ideas, as has been often said? Finally, is religious fundamentalism a driver, a justification, a recruiting mechanism, or all three? Before we get into the discussion, I'd like to introduce the distinguished panelists. Congresswoman Jane Harman is a Democrat that represents California in the U.S. House of Representatives. Representative Harman was first elected in 1992. To represent California's 36th congressional district, which includes parts of Los Angeles County coastline, the Los Angeles International Airport, and the Port of Los Angeles. Representative Harman chairs the Intelligence Subcommittee of the Homeland Security Committee, and as I discovered last night, she is also a Shakespearean actress to boot. Fran Townsend served as assistant to President George W. Bush for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, and chaired the Homeland Security Council. Previously, she was Deputy Assistant for the President and Deputy National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism. She is currently providing consulting service and advice to corporate entities on global strategic engagement and risk, as well as crisis and contingency planning. She also serves on the President's Intelligence Advisory Board. Daniel Benjamin, at my far right, is a director and a senior fellow of the Foreign Policy of the Center of the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His areas of study include U.S. foreign policy, European affairs, the Middle East, jihadist terrorism, and national security. He has also served as the Director for Transnational Threats on the National Security Council and as a speechwriter and special assistant to President Clinton. He has co-authored two award-winning books, The Age of Sacred Terror and The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror, and A Strategy for Getting It Right. The last speaker here is not Hussein Haqqani, which might be on your schedule. And, in fact, he informed us that when we asked him to do this, he wanted us to be sure that he was not Pakistani. But Jeffrey Goldberg is a national correspondent of The Atlantic. Previously, he was a Middle East correspondent and Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, in addition to experience as correspondent for The New York Times Magazine, New York Magazine, and The Jerusalem Post. In 2003, Jeff received a National Magazine Award for reporting his coverage on Islamic terrorism. And based on his earlier panels, he will probably insert some humor if things get so heavy. He could find humor in us getting actually nuked the other day with Chertoff, so I figure he can find some humor here. So to start the discussion, I'll ask each of our panelists to address a couple of questions as a starting point of this, and we'll go through several questions that I have, and then we'll go out to audience questions. So the two questions that I'd like you to start with is, how do you characterize the root causes of Islamic terrorism that spawned this global war on terrorism? This is going to help us, I think, in future discussions about solutions, understanding what the real problem is. And two, how well are we doing? What should we do to improve? So, Jane?
Well, let me start a little differently, because as a policymaker, I've kind of lived this up close and personal. I was there in Congress on 9/11 when we had no evacuation plan, and when 200 members of Congress were milling around in front of the Capitol, which possibly was the intended target of that last airplane that went down in Pennsylvania, and some of you may think it would have been a good thing if that plane had succeeded, because maybe we would have had the change we all so desperately want somewhat sooner, but that's not as good as Jeffrey's humor. And
it's a good start.
Let me start this way. First of all, I believe the threats against us are real. I believe we could be attacked any time, any day in America. I doubt it would be as spectacular as 9/11, but low-level attacks, car bombs, suicide bombers, anywhere or near simultaneously, everywhere, could happen. And we are doing better at protecting against some forms of attack, but as Michael Chertoff said yesterday, this is really risk management. We can't protect against everything all the time. So the threats against us are real. They've changed in many ways since 9/11. Al-Qaeda is no longer as effective a top-down organization as it was then. There is a horizontally linked, loosely affiliated group of nuts out there, many of whom, some of whom are devoutly religious and some of whom aren't. But be that as it may, calling this a global war on terror, as the Bush administration does, I think is counterproductive. And we ought to stop it. That doesn't mean that we ought to stop worrying about terror, but we ought to stop calling it a global war on terror. And we should talk about challenges we face from a loosely affiliated group of people who, for a variety of reasons, choose to cause us harm. And if we do it that way, I think our response will be different. If it's a war, then you need a military response. If anyone has missed how Iraq has gone until recently, a military response was not particularly effective there on the ground once the first phase of the response ended. Our planning was abhorrent. Using the military in the ways that we did didn't work very well. And even now, I agree with Sam Nunn said yesterday, that having our troops be target practice in the middle of a civil war is not a smart use of our troops. Redeploying them to the borders, protecting our embassy, and doing a counterterror mission in Iraq is a much smarter use. So if we stop calling it a war on a tactic, which is terror, and start thinking about what these threats are, then we go to your questions. Mm-hmm. And the real question is, how are we going to win the argument? What we have to worry about is not just the hardcore killers who are out there, who I do think we have to apprehend, but the millions of recruits in the pipeline who are signing up. Some of them are 12 years old. I just read about some kid. The internet is a very good recruiting mechanism, who has blonde hair and blue eyes, you know, who's ready to go and blow himself up in the cause of some greater crazy vision. So how do we stop that? And my answer to that is to do what we have always done well, which is to project our values. We have made huge mistakes in rolling back the rule of law in this country in the last 7 years, invoking the inherent powers of the president basically to ignore laws that Congress has passed, to ignore the need to talk to Congress, to ignore the need to talk to the American people, to ignore the need to really build support for a new framework around the threats that we face. So I think we have to go there. I would hope that President McBama, on day one, would convene a group of the best and brightest, both in his government and in the public, to talk about these issues. And we would build and rebuild a framework, close Guantanamo, make certain that there's no chance ever again of an Abu Ghraib scandal, and think about the Middle East as a region, not just a series of isolated countries, and have a strategy that will help the people in the Middle East become supportive again of America. And I think if we do that, we're going to see a reasonably fast decline in these threats against us.
Well, thank you very much. Jeff?
Thank you. And by the way, I'm happy to speak on behalf of Pakistan if you need me to. I actually think that would be even harder than getting Secretary Chertoff to answer the question about why we still have to take our shoes off at the airport. Hello, Secretary.
But thank you for asking.
Yeah, again.
I don't answer that.
Well, he's here, so maybe we get another shot at the another bite of the apple. let me break off a couple of smaller pieces of what you asked, because you this is an enormous subject. I'm very curious to figure out the root cause of Islamist terrorism, as we all are. And I want to suggest a couple of starting points, a couple of notions. You start to think about this in these terms. I find this useful. Islamist terrorism is in part created, I think, by the collision between a theology of supremacy and the debased reality of the followers of that supremacist religion. And I'm not using that term supremacist religion in an insulting way. Islam holds itself out to be a worldwide religion. There's a concept called dawah, which means carrying that message worldwide. It holds itself to be the final revelation of God and Muhammad as the final prophet. The book is sealed, in other words, and Islam has the answers. Now, if you grow up in an atmosphere which holds that Islam is the true expression of faith in God, I mean, this is not uncommon. Christianity also has this as an issue. And yet you look around you and you see that across the Arab world and even across much of the Muslim world beyond the Arab world, conditions are, as I said, debased. You have joblessness. You have stagnation in education. You have no democracy. And you look at this and you say, well, if we're the people of God, if we're the chosen people of God, and yet we are in an inferior status in the world, every other region in the world is growing economically, growing educationally, and we're stagnating, then what's the cause of this? Some people, some societies, look inward. They're self-critical, and they say, well, maybe we could be doing X, Y, and Z better. Maybe we should be more democratic. Maybe we should enfranchise women. Other people look at it and say, well, it's somebody else's fault. That someone else, very frequently, is America. And what you have in Islam today, and I mean, we can go into this forever. I'll keep this as brief as possible. What you have in Islam today is a religion that sees itself in many ways in decline. It hasn't had a good year since 1683. And I'm not trying to do Bernard Lewis light here, but it's true. From the moment that the Turks were thrown back from the gates of Vienna, Islam, a society that exploded, a movement that exploded out of the Arabian Peninsula and came all the way into Europe, stretched all the way to Indonesia, has been being pushed back, and it's in decline. Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, terrible moment for Islam. And this is something we can get into in a little bit. The challenge of Israel is a key challenge. And the reason that's interesting is because Islam always had a certain relationship with Judaism. Islam was the first class religion, and Judaism was the protected second class religion. Islam treated Jews better for 1,000 years than Christians did, but as long as the Jews knew their place. Zionism comes along and says, well, we want to be equal as a nationality. Islam, the world of Islam, was not ready for that shift. Islam had been battling Christianity for 1,000 years. Sometimes it won, sometimes it lost. But it had never battled Judaism before. And so when Israel rose up, it became a special challenge because the Jews were relegated in the Muslim mindset to a second-class status. And all of a sudden, they were winning wars against Islam. So that was another humiliation and a series of humiliations. The most recent obvious humiliation was the stationing of American troops in Saudi Arabia to protect Saudi Arabia from Saddam Hussein. Again, if you're coming at the world from a perspective of theological supremacy, this is a terrible insult, a terrible humiliation, and has to be addressed. So what I'm talking about is the chasm between the theological hope and the actual on-the-ground reality. And out of that comes a lot of tension. And I'll stop there, but maybe we can talk about it later.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Jane, your views?
Fran.
Sorry.
Fran, how do you feel about Jane?
I've actually had a lot of success working with Jane while I was at the White House and she was in Congress. So we've done a lot of good things together. Let me pick up where Jane Harman left off, and that is, I don't think that there's any doubt that the threat that we face from Al-Qaeda is persistent. They, of course, are looking for the opportunity for us to let our guard down. They've suffered a number of defeats, but it doesn't mean that they don't continue to be dangerous. And we are at a point, I think, where there is an opportunity. The near 7 years without an attack has given us the breath, the freedom, to really be able to have a debate. Look, I think, as Colin Powell put it quite eloquently yesterday afternoon, both candidates want to protect the United States, want to protect the homeland and American citizens. We ought to just accept that as a given. The debate really is going to be, and should be, on the tactics. Now, I think we have to understand al-Qaeda. When you're talking about the threat, al-Qaeda means what it says. That in 1998, bin Laden issued a fatwa declaring war on the United States, and we ultimately saw 9/11. There's been a fatwa issued in 2003 about approving the use of weapons of mass destruction, and there was the whole discussion with Secretary Chertoff yesterday about the likely use of a nuclear weapon. I mean, I think we've got to accept that it is their stated intent to acquire and use such a weapon, and so we have an obligation to take that seriously based on what we know. We're also in a particular period of vulnerability. Whether you go back and look at 1993, the first World Trade Center attack, and in the first 18 months of the Clinton administration, or 2001 with 9/11 in the first year of the Bush administration. And it's not just an acumen on the part of al-Qaeda, a political acumen to understand what that means in the United States. We've seen it in Spain before Aznar's re-election campaign. We've seen it during the G8 in London. And so, and Gordon Brown within the first 72 hours of his taking power in Great Britain. And so we have to understand we're in a particular period of vulnerability. There is good news in this, by the way, and that is that al-Qaeda over the last 7 years has killed more Muslims than Americans. And the answer is that has resulted in diminishing support in the Muslim world, in some ways by people who are better positioned to make the argument about the lack of moral justification for al-Qaeda's actions than the United States government's in a position. One of former supporters, including in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a leader there, a cleric who was a supporter, have made very clear public statements against the actions of al-Qaeda. And so there is diminishing support in the Muslim world that does provide an opportunity for us to really look at how are we going to approach this debate, this global debate about the role of the United States. We have been hugely benefited by our allies around the world. Does that mean that they have been 100% of what we would like? No, but we have benefited from the counterterrorism cooperation in places like Libya, in places like Pakistan, in places like Saudi Arabia. There is no question in my mind that if we are to see a next attack, we are likely to see it emanating out of the tribal region in Pakistan. And so I agree with the discussion yesterday afternoon, what Senator Nunn said. That will probably be the single most urgent counterterrorism foreign policy issue for the next president. We will have to continue to look at what have we learned in the last 7 years. Things like ungoverned and ill-governed spaces are our greatest threat. We saw it originally coming out of Afghanistan. We see it now in the tribal areas, but there are others. Look at the unrest in Yemen, both in the south and the north. Look at Somalia. And so we understand the threat to us by ill-governed or ungoverned spaces around the world. These will all be challenges that the next president, whoever that is, will face. And I think we have the opportunity in the context of the presidential debates and election to ask hard questions. I think we have to have a certain maturity about it to understand that what people say in the context of election may be different than their view when they have the burden of the responsibility in office. But we do need to ask hard questions. Instead of being unhappy when there's a crisis and we don't like the decisions, we need to ask hard questions in the context of the election about what are the priorities, what are the strategic objectives, and what are the tactics that a particular candidate endorses in terms of the implementation of that strategy.
Thank you. Daniel?
Thanks, Bill. Is that working? I was sitting listening to Jeff and wishing that, in fact, he were in Pakistan because he made so many of the points that I wanted to make, and I think he's absolutely right. And Jeff Goldberg is one of the few people I would expect to run into at the buffet at the Pearl Hotel in Peshawar, too. the sense of civilizational humiliation, I think, is really one of the most powerful drivers for Islamist radicalism today. I don't think there's any question about that. It's not just Israel. It's also, think of the experience in South Asia where Pakistanis have fought something like 5 wars against India and not scored a victory yet. This is true wherever, you know, in every part of the world, and from the defeat at the gates of Vienna to the abolition of the caliphate to the creation of Israel and all of these failures on the battlefield, this has been a rough half millennium. But I would add to that a few other things. First of all, there is a global religious revival going on. It's occurring everywhere except for Western Europe. There is a rising tide of religiously motivated violence, and this is a reaction to a number of things. It's a reaction to globalization. It's a reaction, particularly in the Muslim world, to the death of the 2 other ideologies that had held out hope, Arab nationalism and communism. So when there is a vacuum, people come up with another ideology. And believe me, as durable ideologies go, you can't beat Islam. It's been around for a long time. It has a tremendous sense of authenticity. And so there's a natural appeal there. Jeff is also absolutely right that one of the key elements is just what a lousy state the Muslim world is in. And a large part of this has to do not only with the fact that these countries are economically stunted, you know, some of them are having a little better growth than they used to, but they're still horribly set back compared to the West and to lots of other developing areas of the world like East Asia, but they have no political voice, and this has been a huge frustration. And the combination of all these failures has led them to hate their own leaders, and remember that the jihadist ideology began as a revolt against their own leaders, and you saw that with the assassination of Sadat and the uprisings in Egypt and any number of countries. But eventually, there was another set of circumstances which helped turn the course of this rebellion, and that was the success against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, which was the first time that Muslims had really done well against a significant opponent in a long time, and that was a key enabler of the changes we have seen. This gave the mujahideen who were there this sense of triumphalism, a sense that they had the divine wind at their back, and a sense that they could take on ever greater opponents. But what they understood was at the national level that they were being beaten by the mukhabarat, by the domestic intelligence services, and therefore what they needed to do was go after the far enemy. I'm sure that's a term most of you are familiar with, and the far enemy is us, the prop that keeps these autocratic regimes going. And it was, in fact, a very shrewd strategy because they knew that they could elicit with the right kinds of attacks, they could elicit an overreaction from the United States, and they could create this sense of a war between the realm of Islam and the realm of the West. And that would help them advance their own narrative, the core of that being that the West is waging war against Islam, and that a large part of the reason that the Islamic world is in such a devastated condition is because of this alliance between autocrats and infidels. I would just add to that a couple of other things. One is there was a clear understanding of ideology and technology, above all, that they were in an era when a small group of people could take modern technology and cause a lot of damage, and so they were enabled by that as well. And I would add, finally, that another one of the elements in all this, you mentioned the Reformation, is that this is in some way the first stirrings of a Reformation. Because if you look at jihadist theology, it's not about a clerical hierarchy. It's about the assertion of the individual. And in some ways, it's a reaction to colonialism. It's a reaction to that sense that other people were defining the terms of the agenda. Muslims learned at some point that they didn't have to just accept every rote thing that was given to them. They began to have Western-style education, and they wanted Western-style theology in which they interpret what the religion means. And a lot of this is a rebellion against the old existing and highly hollowed out religious structures that exist. So it's all those things coming together in a very toxic situation. I'd say the one thing it isn't is a clash of civilizations. That's what the radicals want, because they figure as long as they foment a clash of civilizations, then their narrative's going to win. And they're going to convince people that that's where the future of Islam lies.
Well, if it is, as both of you, thank you very much. If it is a characterization of sort of a or response to humiliation by the West over the last few hundred years, the question is, you know, how under those conditions can we win the war on terrorism? How can we, or as you characterize it differently, how can we actually stop some of the motive forces that create this set of action against the U.S.?
Well, I actually think this is less hard than might appear. First of all, Dan, you said that Islam was a durable ideology. I think Islam is a religion where 95 or 98% of the people follow the tenets of the Quran, which I haven't read, which has been, I think, perverted to justify certain enormously violent acts. And now, as Fran said, there's pushback inside Islam by very moderate, important voices. There has been pushback before, but that pushback is getting more attention than it had gotten. So I wouldn't define it that way. Here are some simple recipes from Grandma. One is to do what Tom Friedman suggested yesterday, which is to embrace the need for an energy strategy, which we would obviously take the lead on here, an inclusive strategy. For those who hung in there for all 4 hours yesterday, I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And this energy strategy can work in the ghettos, and it can work in Aspen. And the whole point of it is to get our arms around the need to transition away from polluting fuels into something else. And to do that is going to be a big, hard project. And then we export it to the rest of the world. There are lots of folks out there who want to embrace this. And as an export, when you know, I was talking about restore our values. One of our values is America as leader for good. And so that's a piece of it, at least I think so. The second thing is, what are the few things that we have done in the last 7 years that have really gotten international opinion on our side? There are a few, in case you didn't think so. There are response to disasters abroad. Remember the earthquake in Iran, and the earthquake in Pakistan, and the devastating tsunami in Asia. Americans ran to help, and we just did it again, in Myanmar. That kind of response, the generosity, the inherent generosity of America, is one of our best foreign policies. So I am just suggesting that if we get on with it and start solving some of the problems in the world, which we are very good at doing, we will, without even embracing some very serious intellectual issues, which I don't deny, we will be doing more to solve this problem than anything else could do.
Okay. Anyone else? Frank?
Yeah, I mean, is this on?
Yes.
Okay.
I
also think that there is, you know, you talked about earlier this sense of inward looking and sense of humiliation. I think there are two things that are going to be critically important to the future here. And that is, one, a very inward-looking Arab world has to begin to ask themselves the question about education and job. I mean, if you look at the population projections in this part of the world, there is a vastly increasing population under the age of 25 who, one, with an inferior education, have little job prospects. And so there isn't this sense of hopelessness. I mean, we heard this yesterday afternoon in the discussions, and I think that there's a need. This is a very difficult issue for us to address, but we have to encourage and enable a serious look at the economics and the education inside the Arab world. Second, I really do think the next presidential administration is going to have to look for a better way than we have done so far of integrating not only our counterterrorism strategy, But having that inextricably linked to our foreign aid strategy, and it picks up on what Jane's saying, not only in the sense of disasters, but you look at one of the things that really is a success. In Afghanistan, one of the investments there was in their infrastructure to build this ring road. It was an international effort, but it allowed local economies to grow. Regrettably, you know, terrorists also use it to move bad things and bad people, but it was the right thing. Very difficult thing. I tried it when I was in the administration, but because aid strategies are long-term efforts that don't show typically near-term results. But yet we do have to tackle that problem and have our aid strategy so that we're building economies, building healthcare, building education, and it's got to be that when you root out and work with indigenous forces to root out bad guys, you can't leave a vacuum because bad guys will then fill it. And so what you have to do is have the long-term development strategy and aid packages there ready and to work together with local populations.
I guess a question, just a follow-up on that, based on the comments made. It's often the case when the U.S. or the Western powers get in and help other countries that it actually decreases the legitimacy of what's going on rather than increasing it. Is it something that we should directly be involved in or do through others?
It's a very interesting question, and it's very important to note one thing, that I think in the last 5 years, we Americans have learned a little bit of humility. In other words, just because we want Muslims to behave a certain way doesn't mean they're going to behave a certain way. The Iraqis did not instantaneously embrace democracy, though we know that it's the best thing for them. And so it's interesting. There is a when I talk about humility, I mean it in sort of all senses. We need humility to understand that we might not have the solutions for the Arab world. You're absolutely right. There is not a clash of civilizations. We should avoid trying to have a clash of civilizations. What there is a clash within a civilization, within Muslim civilization, I think, between the forces of modernity and the forces of medievalism. And there's not a whole lot we can do on that. I mean, Jane Harman is absolutely correct. We can show our best selves. We can devise an energy policy that works. We can do disaster relief. But in exporting our values, we have to recognize that some of our values, they just don't like. People just don't like them. And, I mean, I'll tell you, if you don't mind, a very quick story. In Afghanistan a few years ago, I was talking to a ex-Taliban official who was then in jail because it was after the invasion. We had a lot of time because he was in jail. And I started asking him, I went beyond the politics, and I said, you know, what is it that you don't like about America? Because I've been very interested in this question of do they not like us for what we do or do they not like us for who we are? And I don't like the single point answer. I think it could be both things at the same time. And I asked this guy, I said, what do you dislike about America? And he said, he gave me the litany, the usual, that you invaded my country, et cetera. But then he started going deeper, and he said, nursing homes, the way you treat old people is horrifying. Television commercials with women in underwear, magazine ads. And he said, and you keep dogs in your homes, and that's repulsive. And I realized in this conversation, well, you know, they see things that we don't see about ourselves, and sometimes it's hard to remember this, but our answers are not always the right answers for them, and that's, I think, something we've learned in the last 5 years.
Yeah, there's a long-term arrogance probably inherited from the British Empire in terms of foreign cultures that we have inherited and continue to move forward on.
Don't get me wrong. Democracy is the answer. I mean, that's one thing that we neglected to mention.
Regardless
here.
Of the question.
Right. Regardless of the... But democracy is... I mean, the economic... when you have freedom, you'll have all kinds of freedom. Yeah, economic freedom, freedom to choose what to study and how to study, the freedom to innovate, the freedom to be an entrepreneur. You'll have all kinds of freedom. So it is the long-term answer.
Could I just make a little comment on this? There's still an us and them aspect to this, which we need to get over. Let's mm-hmm. understand that there is a productive and growing Muslim community in America. There's a huge Muslim community in Western Europe. We've done better at integrating this community than they have. And that is because of the nature of America. Let's keep on keeping on. Let's be more inclusive. And as we do that, it seems to me, why are so many Arabs and Muslims here? because they want to be here. They find our economy productive. I don't think they've been dragged into America. In fact, we're doing many things that keep them out, which I find unfortunate, keep out law-abiding, productive people from our country. But what my point is thinking forward. Sure, we've made lots of mistakes, but by embracing the diversity among us, we will improve our cultural understanding of what's out there, and not just improve it, but improve our tools to help move this clash within a civilization forward, and help the moderate and productive and law-abiding voices all over the world who are connected loosely by the internet and the technology that makes one world thrive and survive, and defeat the nutbags who would sabotage that.
That's the technical term, by the way. I
agree in principle with the idea that there is a clash within the civilization, but I don't think we should let ourselves off the hook too easily, because you know there is a reason why we are the far enemy, and that is we have supported these autocracies, and they have strangled their own societies. They're enormously corrupt. They've kept their people down. They have no interest in the development of their own societies. And if we forget that, then I think we lose our orientation in terms of going forward. The other thing I wanted to say was, you know, the way we go about this is critically important. We have conducted a war on terror that has been 90% military and 10% civilian action. And if you recognize this, as I believe it is, as primarily a counterinsurgency or more of the nature of a counterinsurgency, then it should be 90% civilian action, that is investment, political action, helping people with their needs where they live, and about 10% kinetic force. And we have it all backward. This year, we will spend more than $700 billion on our military because of the demands of the global war on terror. We will spend roughly $30 billion on our diplomacy and our economic assistance. I don't really think this is the American way, but this is what has become the American way, and that's a real problem for us. We're not going to solve their problems for them, but we do need to convince lots of Muslims that we're not the enemy. Otherwise, they will be attracted to radical ideologies. And the way to do that is through improvements in healthcare, is, as Fran suggested, improvements in education, is through promoting economic liberalization, and is through careful, targeted, modest pressure to democratize. We can't democratize overnight. We don't want to have another election where Hamas comes to power, but we got to raise that flag. That's what, you know, that's what it's about. We have to be the face on modernization and a positive modernization, not the face that everyone can point to and say they're waging a war against Islam.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that to Jane's point, this is not only a policy issue, but this is a national security issue. I mean, we've begun to now make sure that we are going out and trying to have more comprehensible, predictable visa standards and push it out so that people, that we are attracting Muslim students from the Arab world into our universities. I mean, we went through a period where that all fell off after 9/11, and it's become a tremendous priority. There's an initiative between Secretary Chertoff and Secretary Rice to right that and to attract people in. But we've got a lot of work to do. Make no mistake about it. Public diplomacy has been of limited value. The most persuasive, I think, effort has been the disaster response in various parts of the world to show the generosity and goodness of America. But this is going to need to be. There are, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of good things going on in discrete parts of the federal government. And I think 7 years without an attack, I come back to that as building for us the ability to step back and say, how do we begin now to make the shift from a primarily military response to have a response that is a now more nuanced, more balanced one that permits us to have the long-term, incorporate more long-term solutions. You know, look, in democratization, it's not going to look like an American democracy. And if we haven't made that clear, that's a mistake. It's not. Democracy is going to take different forms in different parts of the world. There has been some progress, some modest progress in the Middle East. We've seen elections in Kuwait. We've seen elections in Bahrain. The Saudi Arabia had a chamber, you know, sort of a business council elections. Modest, very, very incremental and modest steps. But it points to the fact that what we have to do is maintain the pressure to get them to a place where they continue to make what we will regard as inadequate but modest steps towards a more democratic, open society.
I agree with 99% of what Fran says, as usual. but to get them to a place. I don't agree about that. They have to get to a place. We can't be lecturing them, or we can be, but it's not effective. If we do the right things for us, if we show some humility in the world in addition to that, if we restore the rule of law and respect for Congress and other things in this country, and Congress exercises proper oversight and a lot of our institutions work better and toxic bipartisanship goes away, imagine that, then it seems to me we are doing our part. But there also is, this notion of the Arab as victim, the notion of the African American as victim, as Obama wisely says, is something we have to get. All people have to get past. They have to play a role in charting a good future. And it seems to me that calling on Arab governments and Arab people in the Middle East to show some responsibility, for example, with respect to the future of Iraq, where the present government seems to be showing finally some ability restore some order and reconstruct the country. Telling the Arab world that they need to establish embassies in Baghdad, invest in reconstruction of Iraq, and push back against any tendencies there or in any place near there to support radicalism, which some of these governments continue to do. I mean, is what they ought to be doing.
Can I just make a quick point about what we should be doing? And this is an obvious point, but it hasn't come up yet. I think that the biggest disaster in our post 9/11 response to the world was the decision to become a country that tortures. It's an enormous disaster. And if you listen to people in the Middle East, I mean, I have a friend in Saudi Arabia who once said to me, why do I have to go all the way to America to be tortured? I can get tortured right here. That has been, if we stop that, we solve an enormous part of our problem, because ultimately you need people around the world, not just in the Arab world, to look at America and say, that's a genuinely better society. They treat their citizens better than my country treats us, and we should be more like them. And as long as we torture, they're not going to be able to do that.
I agree completely with Jeff on the torture issue. I would add two other things that we need to do. I think to even gain admission to the discussion with the Arab world or the Muslim world. And one of them is vigorous diplomacy in the Middle East. There is the strong sense, and this has been the most important issue for Muslims from Indonesia to Western Europe, the sense that we're indifferent to the sufferings of the Palestinians. And this hurts us tremendously, and it feeds into the narrative that we want to wage a war against Islam. As Jeff knows better than anyone, getting that diplomacy going and actually providing results is damn near impossible, especially when you have one state that has failed before being born and the other one that has the weakest leadership in its history. But nonetheless, active American diplomacy on the ground, day in, day out, is vitally important, and I hope that the next administration will pursue that. The other thing is, it has to be done in an orderly fashion. It has to be done in a way that we don't leave behind a bigger mess than we found, and that's going to be difficult, but we've got to get out of Iraq. Because the perception to the Muslim world that we are occupiers is permanently damaging. And it is means that we are always starting from so far behind the start line that we are always in a just impossible position. Needs to be done carefully, and it's not clear that we're going to get an outcome that we like, but we need to get out.
Could I just make a plug for the Aspen Institute in the context of what Dan just said? The Aspen Institute formed several years ago a Middle East partnership, and the point of that is to promote economic development in the West Bank, and it is increasingly successful. There just was an investor conference in Bethlehem attended by large numbers of people. Billions, I think over $1 billion in reconstruction money was pledged there. They're leveraging the insurance that the OPIC can provide in America, and there's an equivalent British agency that can provide some of this insurance to private investment. And that steps like that, in addition to whatever a government can do, speak to some of the issues that Dan raised. It doesn't all have to be government-driven, and a lot of the talent in this room is probably already working on this, but in case you aren't, here's an opportunity to do some of this.
If you look at our role and our approach to Iraq and our approach to Afghanistan, one of the things I thought we did very successfully from a military standpoint in Afghanistan is use the Northern Alliance, basically support them so they gain legitimacy. Is there something equivalent that we could do on the diplomatic front, on the civil front, so it's not the U.S. imposing a set of things or bringing something in, but we're doing it a little bit more subtly through other powers in the Middle East?
Well, a friend of mine who used to be a top person in defense intelligence said that when you drive the car over the cliff, your options narrow. And in Iraq, that's been the case. We do desperately need regional diplomacy. And that is enormously difficult given that we have pursued a policy of not talking to the Syrians, not only not talking to the Iranians, but pursuing a two-track process that on the one hand suggests we do want to talk to them if they do a few things, and on the other track suggests that we should pursue regime change. It's hard to get people around the table when they think you only want them around the table as the prelude to disposing of them as a government. So we do need regional diplomacy. We need it desperately. Perhaps when the situation becomes more pacified, we can have a more active UN as well. But I'm afraid that we're quite limited and in this regard. We can't call on too many other countries to put their people on the line, on the ground in Iraq. We'll need a lot more resources in the years ahead, and I think a next president will be in a better position to ask for that from the global community. But we're in a really difficult situation. We caused ourselves an enormous set of problems.
Bill, I actually think that one of the things we've seen after the Battle of Ramadi, you did see a indigenous force inside Iraq of Sunni Muslims who said, we will not tolerate this anymore. And we did build an alliance with them, perhaps arguably too late, but it is working, and it has been a tremendous enabler to the reduction in violence that we've seen in Iraq. And so I agree with you. It was one of the hallmarks of success in Afghanistan, and I think late to it, but we have seen the same sort of success working in Iraq now.
Well, I was actually trying to even extend that beyond the military, which is happening there, but into sort of the civil support that we've been talking about a lot here. Again, will there be a legitimacy to that civil support if it's Americans walking into those countries trying to do that, or do we need to find other venues to do that with American support in a similar fashion?
Yeah, no, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there is no question of the effectiveness that we've seen, including Afghanistan, and now increasing in Iraq, of civil NGO organizations, not U.S. government, and their ability. Jane points to the initiative in the West Bank. We're seeing more of that now in Iraq. But I do think that there is great value in having a non-governmental face on sort of the support for civil society.
And there is the emergence of a vibrant business community in the Middle East. It surely isn't everywhere, but there are well-educated people. There are meccas of education in the Middle East. I mean, Education City in Qatar, for example, is a place where there is, it's the American model, but it's a very impressive set of educational institutions. And Jordan has become a mecca for IT, thanks to His Majesty King Abdullah, who has made that a big focus of his reign. And so it seems to me leveraging that, we can help leverage that. Our multinational corporations can leverage that. Our hotel chains, who work with some of these hotel chains in the Middle East. We were just, Sydney and I were just in Dubai, and it's, for anyone who's missed that, it's you can't even imagine what it looks like there. And so that talent could be part of the investment structure in a resurgent Iraq. And it makes all the sense in the world. For example, for Iraq not just to produce oil, there are all kinds of problems that come from regimes totally dependent on oil, but it was the breadbasket for the Middle East for so long. What about agricultural crops? What about harnessing solar energy, as Saudi Arabia is also talking about? There are just huge numbers of Aspen ideas that could play out there, and we can help generate that. We can even lead it, but Made in the USA doesn't have to be on the top of every project.
Well, thank you. Let me, one other thing you brought up, Jane, was the the government's support of radicalism in the Middle East. What are we actually actively doing about that? Are we really dealing with that effectively?
Well, I'll say it. I think we're sending very mixed messages. If anyone thinks that the Saudis are not exporting money to finance some of the terrorist activities against Israel, Hamas, and other places, they're wrong. I mean, that money is crossing into borders and moving across borders. They have a kind of barter economy, so you can't track it with some of the very good programs that we have. But that has to shut down, and we should make it very clear to people with whom we have strong relationships, regardless of the fact that they are a gas station for us, that practice must be over if they want to do business with the United States.
But how can we tell people who provide us all our oil what to do? I mean, we're a client state.
Well, if we're a client state, then we can kiss goodbye some of our other objectives, including protecting the security of Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. I think we must not be a client state. That is why the things that Tom Friedman and others have been saying are so absolutely critical, in addition to the climate change challenge. There is much more we can do. The President McBama can frame this in a way that I think can inspire Americans to follow him. Let's understand that $5 a gallon gas has created political will to do something different, and people are acting on it. They're not buying big gas-guzzling trucks. Our auto companies are in deep doo-doo because practices are changing. And so there have to be other answers. And with those other answers come additional options. And we're going to have a clear-eyed foreign policy about the people we deal with in the Middle East, let alone other places in the world, if we want to get to a place where we support regimes that are moderate and transparent and surely can embrace the Muslim faith, as Turkey's regime does. But that's a kind of model for the kind of regime I think we want to see all over the Middle East, and it will benefit millions and millions of people.
So we get some questions from the audience. I wanted to just finish with one thing, and you can add your point in there as well. If provided the opportunity to advise McBama or O'Kane, the new presidential candidates, what would be your top three recommendations for improving our success in GWAT? And we'll start with you. And whatever your other comment was as well.
I would just say, to Jane's point about the stopping the flow of money, particularly out of Saudi Arabia, this has been a huge priority. And while by no means solved, I agree with Jane that we have to do better. But we have gotten unprecedented cooperation. They have a financial intelligence unit. They're about to get admission to the Egmont Group, which is an international body that sets standards for tracking the transparency of financial flows. And frankly, the great test to me when I was in the administration was to go to the Israelis, who literally would say back to me that our efforts have absolutely substantially reduced the flow of funds out of Saudi Arabia into the international terror community. And so while I agree there's a great deal more that needs to be done, we have made some progress on that. Okay, so to your question on that, what's the recommendation? I think that it is time. As a world community, and this is not necessarily something that I think the U.S. must lead, but I think the U.S. must build consensus in the world, we have to call for the end of the state sponsorship of terrorism. The greatest deal of money going is from state sponsors. It cannot any longer, just as by international consensus, we brought an end to slavery, to fascism, we must bring an end to that the notion of the use of terror organizations to implement your foreign policy is acceptable in any way. We must, as an international community. And so I think the next president has got to make that a priority to building the international consensus to bring that to an end. I do believe that we have to have a serious strategy to integrate both our counterterrorism and our foreign aid so that we see long-term developments that don't permit terrorists to come back in into areas where they have been largely defeated, and that we see the long-term progress that we need. And I do think, as a national security issue, the next president, regardless of who it is, has got to make comprehensive immigration reform a priority. It is what's made this country great. I am the granddaughter of immigrants. Everybody I suspect in this room is in at some generation was an immigrant. And so we have to get past the absolutely toxic, debilitating rhetoric, partisan rhetoric on this, and build consensus in this country to ensure that we have, because it is, I'll tell you, when you look at immigration regimes, Canada has just made theirs easier to attract those with high-tech skills into Canada because they're having difficulty getting into the United States. And so we have to have comprehensive immigration reform. Secretary Chertoff and the department have made great gains on the security side, but that's only one piece of it. You need a much more comprehensive approach.
Thank you. Daniel?
I think that the overarching advice to the next president would be, to repeat something I said before, change the story. This is ultimately about stories. It's ultimately about the allegiance of 1.2 billion Muslims. It's ultimately about the direction that that community, or many, many communities, really, because there's no one Muslim world, heads in the future. And my own feeling is that the net effect of the last 7 years has been the inadvertent confirmation of our enemy's narrative. We hate them. That's what they think. I'm not as sanguine as Fran is about the polling. It is true that al-Qaeda has overreached in Iraq and committed atrocities and alienated a lot of people. But my colleague Shibli Talhami has done a lot of polling in the Middle East and found that 30% of Muslims will still say that they admire al-Qaeda for standing up to the United States. Well, you do the math, what 30% of 1.2 billion is. It's not very encouraging. So I think that that has to be the overarching goal, change the story, make it so that there's a positive agenda for the Muslim world in the global community, and that the United States recognizes that we cannot prosper when others are sinking, when others are under the thumb of autocracies, when others are subject to deeply corrupt, often vicious regimes. And I suggested a whole bunch of things that we can do in that regard before involving the Middle East peace process, Iraq, and the other thing. But the one other point I would make comes back to something Jane said, and that is I think we really need to keep a very watchful and in many senses, warm eye on the American Muslim community. This is a community that's glad to be here, that is deeply worried about its future should there be another attack. If you talk to leaders of the community, they will say our biggest fear is that after the next attack, we will lose our civil liberties. And the key policy goal for the United States ought to be to convince American Muslims that they are here, that they are fully integrated, that they are part of this society, they have a stake in society, and that they ought to remain immune to radicalism, which is one of the reasons why we have not had an attack here. There are not very many people who want to sign up in bin Laden's army in the United States, and that is a success story, and we've got to keep it that way. We are fortunate in that we are not in the European situation where there's a much deeper alienation between elements of the Muslim communities there and the state and the broader society. So those would be my recommendations.
Thank you. Jeff?
Very quickly, as distasteful as this seems to me and probably others, I would start from day one to try to break Syria away from Iran. That might be the most important thing, one of the most important things for the Middle East peace process. It certainly would go a long way to isolating Iran from the Arabs. And this is a related point. I would suggest that the next administration listen very carefully to our Sunni Arab allies who understand something that I think a lot of people in America don't, which is that Iran has been waging a war against the United States for 30 years. Whether or not we want to acknowledge that, whether or not it's hot or cold, they've been waging war in various ways. Our Sunni Arab allies are very, I just got back from Jordan, they're very worried that we don't understand Iran's zero-sum game in the Middle East, which is in order for us to reach primacy, we have to kick America out. Breaking off Syria would be huge in that. And supporting, and again, this is also distasteful because in 2003, I don't think I would have said this. I would have said, let's advocate for democracy in Egypt. Let's push hard in Jordan. Let's push hard in the Gulf. At this point, I think I have a little bit more of a realpolitik understanding of how fast or how slow democracy is going to come. Right now, I would say that we should be aligned with our Arab allies against the threat threat of Iranian hegemony. The other thing I would say, agreeing with Dan, is that we need to focus on the Middle East peace process without without sort of a Pollyanna-ish view of what's possible. You have a state in the Palestinians. The Palestinians aren't even a state, and it's already a failed state. To underscore Jane's point, this Aspen Initiative to build up the West Bank is an enormously important thing. If you build up the West Bank, if you make life on the West Bank better, and that, of course, requires the cooperation of the Israelis as well, if you make life better and you broadcast that into Gaza, there's a chance that people in Gaza will eventually say, you know what, living under Hamas isn't the greatest thing in the world. And the final thing I would say is that you have to declaratively end torture from day one and make a speech to the Arab world saying that you're doing that. And more than that, I just yesterday, late afternoon, I took a tour of the Aspen City Jail, which is a lovely jail, as you would... it's the Little Nell of jails, really. And we missed an enormous opportunity in Iraq. We missed an enormous opportunity in Afghanistan to show our enlightenment to people. And even when we have to jail people, and unfortunately, we still have to jail people in Afghanistan and Iraq, they should all look like the Aspen City Jail, the Aspen Town Jail. I mean, and they should. And people will come out having not been tortured, having been fed well, having been given good conditions, and saying, you know what, even when I have a negative interaction with America, it's not so bad. And that's part of this of the torture package. It's behaving in a way that makes them jealous of our rights, jealous of our liberties, and wanting to have those themselves.
I would retire the term global war on terror and maybe replace it with global war on poverty or global challenge for opportunity, something like that, because I think that would encourage us to view this in a much more effective way, which is not to say that I think the world isn't dangerous. I agree that Iran continues to pose a huge threat to the existence of Israel and to our national security interests. But I'd point out that 850,000 Iranians live in Los Angeles, the largest Iranian community outside of Tehran. That's why it's called Tehrangeles. And there are opportunities. Sounds like a bug, doesn't it? There are opportunities that we are not taking to help encourage properly dissent inside Iran. The Persian community is a plurality but not a majority, and there are strong minorities who are not happy with this government. The Iranian people, many of them, love America. That's true all over the Arab world. It's their governments that they don't love and we shouldn't love. At any rate, that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is restore the rule of law in America. I think calling it getting rid of torture may be a little too simple. What it should be is we should have a proper set of laws, some of which need to be updated still, to confront the threats of the 21st century world. And some of those threats are very serious, and some of our tools should be pretty tough tools, but they should be decided upon in the public square with buy-in from people who understand that security and liberty are not a zero-sum game. And that is certainly a view I have, and this should be part of that debate starting on day one. And finally, I do think our next administration should talk to governments all over the world. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be preconditions. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't speak when we have leverage. Both of those things are true. But we should never announce in advance that certain governments are off limits and they are the axis of evil, which only drives them to harder and harder policies against us.
Well, thank you. We now have some time for questions from the audience in the yellow jacket.
Is there a remote possibility that this toxic partisanship will end and that there would be a possibility of a Manhattan Project on energy so that we wouldn't have to depend on these countries? Is there a remote possibility to stop that toxic?
I certainly hope so. I recall a time when Richard Nixon was president, and I was a staffer to a California senator, Democratic senator, in the Senate. Impeachment was going on, and imagine this. The Senate functioned, his cabinet functioned, and on a bipartisan basis, we were trying to solve problems. It wasn't a pleasant experience living through that. But Congress worked. If Congress could work then, Congress can work now. And I do think the next president has a huge opportunity to fix the problem, and should. And given the fact that both of the options come from the United States Senate, and both of them are talking about this, I certainly hope we'll all hold them accountable. My quality of life depends on it. And for those of you who are sympathetic, and I would hope that all of you would be sympathetic, including Sidney Harmon, to this challenge, you'll help make sure the next president carries through on this.
Jim Woolsey in the back.
I can always hear Jim Woolsey.
Jim Woolsey doesn't have a problem with projection.
Yeah. My fellow Shakespearean
and
actor.
And you should have seen his legs last time.
The part of the world you all have been discussing is filled with irony, and one of those ironies was pointed out very cleverly by Professor Sean Wilentz of Princeton right after 9/11. Sean spoke here earlier in the week when he said, if you look at the fact that 15 of the 19 attackers were Saudi, that the operational head, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was an engineer, the number two man, Zawahiri, a physician, and the leader, a scion of an extraordinarily wealthy construction family, you have to see that we must understand that the root causes of terrorism are clearly wealth, status, and education. Now, there's another irony, which is that the last three presidents have intervened with major American military force five times against starvation or secular regimes on behalf of Muslims. Bush 1 freed Kuwait from Ba'athist secular Iraq. He also intervened in Somalia to feed Muslims. The Clinton administration went to war twice with Serbia, Christian Orthodox Serbia, on behalf of Bosnian and Kosovar Muslims from the air, but successfully so. And Bush, too, went to war against secular Ba'athist Iraq. And if you talk to any Iraqi Shiites today about the degree of freedom they have to practice their religion compared to under Saddam Hussein, you have to say that perhaps not only was Sean right, but there's a further irony, which is that the United States should avoid using military force to feed, protect, or free Muslims. Would you agree?
Who would like to take that one on?
I think Fran Townsend has to answer that question.
Yeah, me too.
Daniel.
Well, Jim, to your first point about wealth, status, and education, when was it ever otherwise with, a terrorist movement? Terrorists are intellectuals. They tend to come from the leisure of the theoried class, as was once wittily said. This is a response of people who have been half or more westernized to the conditions within their own world. And so it is certainly true that poverty is not the reason for terrorism. It's not the reason for the radical Islamist reaction to the West. But it suggests that there is a real ideology here at work and that there are ideas that we need to grapple with. On the issue of the American history as the protector of Muslims, you make a very important point, which I think underscores the difficulty of getting control of the global discussion. We inhabit a world in which we all are in different media universes and all different cognitive universes. And to us, it seems like it's almost turning on a dime. Well, we'll just be nicer to them and they'll like us more. Well, this is absurd. The Muslim world has been subjected to broadcasting from many different sources, including Muslim governments, which have been extraordinarily deft at deflecting blame for the cause of the disarray in Muslim societies onto the West. Muslim clerics have often chimed in with this. Their supporters in the former East Bloc were all too happy often to play in harmony with this. So there's no end of sources for the demonization of America. We've also not helped ourselves by sending out mixed messages. Shiites may be better off, but the vast majority of the Muslim world views the occupation of a Muslim country as an obscenity. I think that what we really have to think hard about is sustained action and sustained efforts to change minds. And this is something that we are uniquely bad at doing because of the nature of our political system, our quadrennial cycle, the fact that we lose attention in a heartbeat, and we seldom have been able to craft a grand strategy that lasts very long. The one time we've done this was during the Cold War. And we made it very clear that during the Cold War that our sympathies were with the captive peoples, that we were not against them or their societies, we were against their governors. And I think that's the sort of thing we need to do now, and we have to recognize it's going to take a long, long time, and we're going to have to be consistent, and we're going to have to stick with it. We need a bipartisan consensus for a policy like this. You can't do it from one administration that's on one side of the aisle and then change direction with another one.
Jane had some things she wanted to add.
In calling for a global war on poverty, Jim, I wasn't implying that this movement against us is all from poor people around the world, but I was saying, as I said at the beginning, we need to win the argument here. And one of the recruiting tools, one of them is our current disrespect for the rule of law. Another one is our enormous disregard for some of the conditions in the Middle East and around the world. We're compassionate when there are disasters, but we're not strategic with respect to how to provide reasonable, fair education tools to everyone, access to jobs, and so forth. And the export of energy strategy jobs may be the way to do that. So you're right, and Dan is also right, that there has been an intellectual leadership of this that remains highly dangerous. Let me just say, I think Michael Chertoff was here. I don't know if he's here now. There he is. That we need a Department of Homeland Security, and we need a strategy behind our Department of Homeland Security, which I know you're doing your level best to insert, because the threats against America are dangerous. But that alone, that's while it's partly offense, it's too much defense. The real offense will come, it seems to me, from a lot of the things that we've been discussing up here, which is a strategy to win the hearts and minds, to use that cliche, around the world and change the views of America.
Just one small quick point. It is true that the Bush administration will be remembered as the most pro-Shiite American administration in history. I'm just not sure that's a good thing yet.
I think we have probably time for one or two more questions in the green back there.
Thank you. Is it on?
Yeah.
Follow up to this conversation. Three of the four panelists focused on the importance of economic development. One of the panelists, his initials are Jeff, just focused on the need for democracy. The Gallup organization does this World Voices, and there's one common theme in every country around the world. People want a job. Why do you think democracy is the answer when economic development is necessary for a real democracy? We had a democracy in Lebanon. I think we have a real misguided notion that democracy is the answer. We've got to focus on economic development. You can't have a democracy without a stable middle class. Why would Egypt be any better off than Lebanon with a democracy?
Actually, I spoke for 3 minutes about the importance of economic development on the West Bank, and I agree that economic development is tremendously important. I think economic development can be a byproduct of democracy. I also stated that I'm more of a realist now and understand that democracy might lead to more fundamentalism. But I think these things, I don't think you can impose a Singapore model necessarily on the Middle East. I think that you need things to go hand in hand. And I think economic development, innovation, entrepreneurial innovation comes from freedom. It doesn't come from having repressive governments who won't even let their people have unimpeded access to the internet.
One question, the lady in the American shirt.
Very, very quickly, I just wondered, considering you're saying now that this is not a clash of civilizations or of cultures, what will be the effect if we bomb Iran?
Well, whatever you think of Cy Hirsch, I recommend you read his article in the latest New Yorker, and particularly his quotation, which has not been denied by Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who said if we bomb Iran, and we may need to, but if we bomb Iran, we should recognize that we will have generation upon generation of jihadists as far as the eye can see. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that is a worse outcome than Iran having a nuclear weapon, but it's certainly something that people should think about long and hard before they do it.
Anyone else?
Well, I mean, Iran is the, I mean, just further to Dan's point, I mean, I think that's right. There is no question Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. Hezbollah, prior to 9/11, had killed more Americans. It is the group that Iran's, one of the groups Iran sponsors. And so, and they have tremendous capability all around the world. And you can expect, and you've got to be prepared for as part of your calculation as to whether or not, to Dan's point, you decide that that is the preferable outcome. You must understand, that, and they've done attacks in Buenos Aires and around the world, that that is going to be the most likely near-term consequence of it, and it is likely to bring itself into the future. And so the capability there is frighteningly capable, you know, real and widespread, and so this is a calculation that the next president most likely will have to address.
Well, I'd like to take time for more questions, but I think we're at the point. I'm sure the panelists would be glad to answer some questions one-on-one after this. Time's up. I want to thank the panelists for a very interesting discussion.